morphologically, but it turns out that they're actually closer related to diversifolia, although they are distinct, so it may be a new species. And this just shows where that little island is. It's a tiny volcanic island that formed about 2 million years ago, and it's about equidistant between Korea and Japan. So how is this information being used, putting some of the resistance, hemlock resistance studies in context? So this shows some results from a paper by Anthony Lagoante and Mike Montgomery, where they're looking at the terpene components in the different hemlock species, and they found that the two eastern species, Caroliniana and Canadensis, actually have very close terpene compositions, although they're not closely related to each other. Are we frozen? There we go. And so another recent paper, they speculated using their terpene information and also understanding of the relationships among hemlocks. They speculated that eastern North American hemlocks historically have had considerable pressure from native caterpillars. And based on fossil records, it's been hypothesized about 5,000 years ago that defoliator outbreaks might actually have caused hemlocks to become almost extinct. So they thought that faced with pressure from defoliators and the absence of native sucking insects such as adelgids and scales, the chemistry of these eastern hemlocks may have drifted away from protection against sucking insects, which is why these two species have maybe independently, because they have different ancestries, developed susceptibility to the adelgid. And another way that this information is being used, there's some resistance breeding work being done at the U.S. National Arboretum, where they've tried to hybridize Canadensis with the Asian species. That's always been unsuccessful, but they have been successful crossing Caroliniana with the Asian species, which makes sense because Caroliniana does fall into a clade with the Asian species. So these hybrids have been planted since 2004, and they've been starting to grow. I guess my pictures are big. And some of these hybrids have turned out to be very resistant to the hemlock, such as, or to the adelgid, such as this very nice looking hybrid between Chinensis and Caroliniana. And finally, I'm going to talk a little bit about some work I've been doing with a natural enemy group that are being evaluated and released for biocontrol of the adelgid. It's a genus of beetle called Laricobius. They're deradontid beetles. And the major players I listed here on the left, Laricobius nigrinus, is native to western North America, and it has been introduced into eastern North America as a biocontrol of hemlock woolly adelgid. We also have a native species, Laricobius rubidus, which is here in eastern North America. There's another native western North American species, Laricobius laticolus, which is thought to be more associated with with Adelgis coolii. Another species, Laricobius ericksonii, was introduced back into eastern and western North America back in the 50s and 60s in attempts to control the balsam woolly adelgid. And as far as I know, it hasn't been collected again since the 60s. There's also another undescribed species from Japan, which is being now evaluated as another biocontrol against the adelgid. So as I mentioned, Laricobius nigrinus has been released. More than 30,000 beetles have been released so far. And they've been focusing on releasing it along the leading edge of adelgid activity where population density is low but growing. So after they release the beetles, they do post-release monitoring where they go out into the field and beat trees or clip off branches and get larvae. And to be able to identify those larvae, you have to rear them out to adult. The native and the introduced species can't be distinguished as larvae. So it's a long process, expensive. They pupate and estivate in the soil, and many of them die at that point. It's very hard to get all of them to emerge as adults. And when you get adults, you use, among other things, you have to dissect out the male genitalia and compare, and if it looks more like this, it's one species, more like this, it's the other species. So it's pretty difficult to distinguish the different species. So I've done some phylogenetic work with Laricobius. This tree includes CO1, ITS2, and EF1-alpha. It's just a neighbor-joining tree at this point. It's a work in progress. I'm still hoping to get some outgroups to use here. So we have the Asian species. We also have a Chinese species, Kangdiensis, and the undescribed Japanese species. And then we have one sample of Laricobius caucasicus from the Caucasus. They group together. The European species, Laricobius ericksonii, Laticolus, the other Western North American species, and then we have Nigrinus and Rubidus. So Laricobius nigrinus, we found was very closely related to Laricobius rubidus. And for what it's worth, there was about 1.8% sequence divergence in CO1 between these two species. So we probably should be looking into whether these two species can hybridize, and if so, what are the implications for control? We did find that there were 12 diagnostic sites in CO1 that do distinguish the two species, and we used these diagnostic sites to develop an RFLP assay to be able to distinguish them very quickly and easily. So the RFLP, the basic idea is if you have a larva, you can do the assay, you amplify the CO1 gene, use restriction enzymes to cut it, and it gives you a different pattern for the different species, and then you can figure out which species it is. So it's inexpensive, fast, reliable, and it's now being used by Gina Davis and Scott Salem at Virginia Tech to monitor the establishment and spread of Nigrinus. And I want to thank all these individuals who have been involved in the project. Thank you. Questions? Why doesn't it? Why doesn't it? I'm not sure. I mean, it's hard to say. There just aren't any native species on our hemlocks there. You know, one very speculative possibility is when there was a very rapid and extensive reduction of the range of hemlock about 5,000 years ago, and they're not really sure why, but they've maybe implicated an herbivore outbreak in that. So maybe the population just got so low that they couldn't support the adelgid, or I mean, it's really hard to say going back that far. Dan?
How does the resistance of the Western North American species compare to the Eastern North American species?
The Western North American species do seem to be resistant to the adelgid. You know, they've been doing some common garden work here on the East Coast. But another thing to keep in mind is that in the West Coast, it's a different adelgid. So if it's you know, if we're looking at resistance in the West compared to resistance in the East, to you know, Western hemlocks growing in the East, we're looking at different adelgids. So that's definitely something to keep in mind. But yes, the Western hemlocks do seem to be resistant. Mountain hemlock, for sure, you can hardly ever find adelgids on it. Thank you.
For those of you that are not familiar with emerald ash borer, it was detected first in North America in 2002, separately in Ontario as well as Detroit, Michigan. It is suspected to have arrived in packing material from Asia. It attacks all species of Fraxinus as well, as far as I can understand. And with the work with Nathan Seeger and Deb McCullough, they believe that it arrived in the early 1990s with dendrochronography work. The females can lay about 60 to 90 eggs, the larva feed on the cambium layer, which is the most is the destructive phase of the insect, and it is capable of killing a healthy adult ash tree within 2 years. Now, the economic importance of this pest is extraordinary. There are over 650 million ash trees in Michigan alone. The uses of ash ranges from tool handles to baseball bats to recreation, which a lot of Michigan economy is based off camping sites. The nationwide estimates, if for just the urban street trees, if all of the urban street trees of ash are gone nationwide, it's ranging about $20 to $6 billion. However, if you look at all of the ash trees in forests, there are over 7.3 billion ash trees in the nation, and that estimated cost is going to cost about $280 billion for our economy. There is some phenotypic variation of this insect. Generally, is this metallic green. It's a beautiful insect, sadly, but this metallic green is the common phenotype. And the ones that we find mostly in North America are the ones with black eyes. However, they are found with copper eyes in very low amounts. And then we also get these brilliant pink, kind of a ruby color. I also have some in my collection that are brilliant blue, or you get these bronze colors. There's one in my collection that was collected by Sarah Smith that has one blue elytra and one green elytra, which is beautiful but unusual. The life cycle of this insect, they lay their eggs in the interspaces of the bark. They hatch out and bore into the wood and feed into the cambium layer. They go through four larval instages. They form this typical S gallery. They prepupate, so they fold onto each other, and then they form the pupa. They emerge out of the wood as adults, forming this D-shaped exit hole, which is a good scouting technique to look at this for this. They mate, and the whole process happens again. And unfortunately, this larva stage does this to the tree. And we see this throughout Michigan, throughout Midwest, actually, through the many states that has been found so far, as well as in Ontario, that our wonderful, gorgeous, healthy ash trees are systematically being declined and they are dying. The native range of this insect is in China, the Far East, Russia, Korea, Japan, as well as some sites in Taiwan. The current range in North America right now is extensive throughout Michigan. It's also found in Illinois, Indiana, Ohio, Pennsylvania. There has been a single population that has been located in West Virginia. As well as a couple, if you notice, up here in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan and Ontario. We can't forget Canada. They're also battling this pest. So to figure out and try to answer some questions about this invasive species, I'm trying to use a variety of genetic techniques, starting with mitochondrial genes. They have been used for determining geographic origin of other invasive species. For example, Cognato et al. Used the cytochrome oxidase 1 gene to look for the geographic origin of the red turpentine beetle. It is a North American beetle that was introduced into China, and they were able to isolate where it came from in North America, and we believe that the Pacific Northwest is the origin of the Chinese population. And this beetle was devastating their pine forests, so it was very important for them to know where it came from. And it is also throughout North America, so finding the natural enemies in the Pacific Northwest to control it was something that the Chinese group was very interested in. Graputo also used the CO or cytochrome oxidase 2 gene to look at the Colorado potato beetle. It was introduced into Europe And they actually were able to determine that there was decreased genetic variation within Europe, which actually they believe is a signature of a small single introduction from North America. Now for my research, I'm using a cytochrome oxidase 1, about 450 base pairs, and this is our current haplotype network. This big circle represents the main haplotype that I'm seeing, and as you notice, most of the individuals from North America are found here, many individuals from China. I also have some from Moscow, Russia, which is interesting in itself because that was probably also an introduced population. Because if you remember on the map, it's naturally found in Far East Russia, but it is not anywhere close to Moscow, Russia. So we're trying to figure out where that one came from as well. And there are some individuals from Korea that are on this big haplotype. There is one individual from Japan that is extremely different from everything else, and I suspect that this is probably a different species. It was combined a number of years ago into the same species, and I don't think that that was valid, but I need more specimens to be able to validate that. Korea does show a lot of genetic variation. We do find one single individual from Canada that is now showing differences than other individuals in North America. And we are seeing a little bit of variation within China, but that is not the those are specific populations that we don't believe that were the origin of the North American population. So we did attempt nuclear genes because they have been used to look at population structure within insects. The Mediterranean fruit fly, this looks like a big jumbly mess, so just ignore it. It's a pretty picture. But they actually used the intron section of these four nuclear genes to determine the population structure of the Mediterranean fruit fly, which was introduced into California. What they did find using the population assignment test is it more than likely the individual Mediterranean fruit fly that was found in 1996 was a single introduction from the Latin American group, and they were able to rule out other population origins of that single introduction. California did also have other introductions of the Mediterranean fruit fly. However, more than likely that single individual that was located in 1996 was not from the previous introductions of the Mediterranean fruit fly in California. So given that it was working, or it did work for other invasive species, I did try four different genes, wingless, phosphophenylpyruvate, carboxykinase, cytochrome C, and elongation factor 1, to determine if we could find population structure and see if we can get origin with EAB. However, this is pretty much most of my gels. I had many, many bands throughout all of my genes that I was looking at, so I just am not doing this anymore. It was not a likely candidate to be helpful. So we progressed onto the amplified fragment length polymorphisms. This is a